Hello, listeners. I'm Martin Gessler, and today we're going to be talking about the film, or miniseries, depending who you ask, Berlin Alexanderplatz. And joining me are a pair of gentlemen with a set of good, strong arms between the two of them, Chris Funderburg and John Cribbs.
Good for lifting fruit pallets.
Thank you, gentlemen, for first of all, for coming back, and second of all, for agreeing to a film that has such a big time commitment to watch. So thank you.
You're welcome. It was fun. It was great to watch it again.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was great to have an excuse to revisit that world.
It was good. For listeners, last time we talked, we discussed the films of Shohei Imamura, and a few things came up that, Fassbinder's name specifically came up, but listening back to it after when I was editing, it made me think a lot specifically of Berlin Alexanderplatz when we were discussing the relationship between victim, victimizer, things like that.
Yeah.
And the story, the basic plot, I guess you could say it's about a man named Franz Bieberkopf who's just released from prison in Germany in 1928. And he tries to go straight and live a good, decent life, but things don't quite work out that way. He sort of proceeds to get hurt by people and to hurt people, and has his brushes with politics, with crime, with relationships that go bad. And that all sort of culminates in a woman he has a relationship with who gets the name Mitze from him, who's murdered by a man that he loves, I guess you could say, named Reinhold. And then Franz goes into a sort of hallucinogenic state of madness before going on trial against Reinhold. And then I guess he ends up as a...
assistant gatekeeper?
Gatekeeper, yeah. He's assistant gatekeeper at the very end, watching over all these automobiles. So that takes a little over 15 hours to watch, depending which version. And would you say that's about the plot, or I don't know if I'm
in a nutshell. I think one thing that Fassbinder liked to say was that the plot is almost completely secondary to this work of art. You know, that it can really be summed up very briefly, but doesn't really dig into what it is. The novel that's based on, the Alfred Doblin novel, is really a series of vignettes or people that Franz Bieberkopf runs into, almost in sort of the picaresque tradition of, you know, very gaudy or kind of
Tristan Shandy,
distasteful, yeah, situations happening. And the main character just kind of becomes involved in one thing or the other. And I think what Fassbinder finds interesting about it isn't so much, you know, the progression of Franz Bieberkopf and how he, you know, develops or changes throughout the course of it, more so how his worldview affects the things around him and how he is unable to deal ultimately with this naive notion that he has that there is goodness in the world and that everything, that there's a good side to everything, where in this Weimar Republic that he lives in, this particular time and place, everything is kind of against that idea. And as much as he loves Reinhold, this character who is, you know, he will not hear arguments that he is a bad person. And he won't hear a bad thing about the other people around him.
I won't have you knock Reinhold.
Yeah, constantly. It's for him, it's just he has this attitude towards his environment that is completely against it. And ultimately it breaks him when he realizes that he can't survive with this kind of an honest belief in humanity. So it's, what would you call it, Chris? It's more of like an attitude. It's more of a characterization, I think, than a classic story or a narrative.
Well, I think part of the problem with discussing this film is obviously the where do you start with it? How do you start to dig in with it sort of question? And I was definitely surprised watching it this time. When I think about what this film is about, it's about Franz and Mitze and Reinhold, right? Mm-hmm. They're not even in, it's a 15 or 14 part series, right? They're not even in until the second half.
They come in fairly late. Like, Mitze, she's only introduced after his arm is lost.
Yeah.
Which is a detail I forgot to mention, but...
yeah, so you can say it's about one thing or the other, but so much stuff happens in this. And this is the third... I watched it again leading up to recording this podcast, and this is the third time I've seen it. And there was so much I didn't remember, and so many characters that felt really important this time that I genuinely didn't even remember. Like Lena, the Polish girl, she in some ways this time feels just as important as Mitza to me, but I didn't even remember her. Like she was just part of the parade of women at the beginning. The first half of the series is a bunch of women sort of floating in and out of his life. And in fact, that's where he starts to develop his relationship with Reinhold, as Reinhold has this plan of, I get bored of women quick, so I'll pass them off to you when I'm done with them. It's sort of like a, you know, it's the Mac part from the dentist system. I think we can all agree on that. Is that Reinhold wants
It's Always Sunny.
Wants him to play the Mac role in the dentist system.
I thought you were talking about Mech for a second. There's a character named Mech.
No, but so what this film is, there's just so much of it. And if you try and pare it down, I mean, also just, it's also about his relationship to this gang. He gets in with Poom's gang through his friend Mech, and that's how he meets Reinhold. And it's about him sort of trying to figure out what to do for work with the idea that it's Germany. It's 1928. The book was written in 1929. Hyperinflation has stalled, but unemployment is still huge. What does an ex-convict who's just gotten out of jail do in these sort of very fraught economic conditions? And what is, especially a former convict who was a pimp, and who does not have a lot of prospects, what's his relationship to crime, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where John brings it up, is that it's about goodness. To me, this movie, especially, there's two things. There's Fassbender, the book is different than the movie, and Doblin, who's a very strong artist in his own right with a strong perspective, wants to do different things and is interested in different things than Fassbender. And so you sort of end up in a conversation discussing those simultaneously. But what this series is about theodicy. It's about, why does evil exist in the world? What mm-hmm. is the sort of theological nature of badness, of evil, you know? And it considers good, I think, in that lens, you know?
Yes.
How do you do good? What is good and bad? Why does evil exist? Why does bad exist? And I think Doblin has one view on it and Fassbender has another, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, what I think sort of makes Franz compelling as a character is you really do want things to turn out for him. You know, he does bad things, but you keep sort of hoping.
Do
that...
you? This time I did not.
You did?
No, this
well,
time
like,
I did
I mean,
not.
Fassbender, but like I was going to say, like he undercuts it with... Like, there's a moment when, you know, he's off with Mitza and things are settling and he's sort of getting happy for Franz. And then he replays it several times. But the first time he replays Franz murdering the girlfriend that he was put in prison for at the very beginning.
Yeah.
That flashback. And then, you know, I think there's narration. I assume it was from the book where it's describing sort of a pleasant scene. And it's like, you know, you could forget, like, oh, he's off with Mitza and it's this nice scene, but you're watching what he did and he just doesn't let you forget what he did and what he's capable of. And like, I think it's important to keep that in mind.
There's one episode, I think it's episode 9, where he replays it twice in one
twice,
episode.
Yeah.
Incessantly.
And that's
yeah.
after it was replayed, I think, already in the previous one. So if you're watching those back to back, it's like 3 in a row.
Yeah.
But like, I think it's sort of important to understand that Franz, like, you do kind of want him to turn around, but at the same time, like, he, I don't know, there's this thing I always hear, like, when people say, like, oh, like, the, you know, this person, he's got a good heart, you know, they even say it in Berlin Alexanderplatz, like, oh, like, don't worry about him, he's got a good heart, he's a good person, and, like, that's always from people who do horrible things, you know, like, people don't realize how horrible a thing a good person can do, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost like Fassbender doesn't want to let Franz off the mm-hmm. hook, you know.
Sure.
I feel like in the book, and I should say I have never read the book, so I don't have, you know, great insights into it, but my thought is that the idea that he murdered a woman and then went to prison and then is now coming out at the beginning of the story back into the real world, I would guess that Dublin is more interested in following him in this kind of new childlike sort of, being released into the world as it is now and his sort of relationship to that. I think he can almost probably he probably let's puts that in the background, whereas Fassbender definitely doesn't want us to forget about that. I think he kind of dwelled on the idea that like this guy is a murderer at the end of the day. He's not only a murderer, but he is a violent man who murdered a woman, who could have stopped any time and kept going. So even though technically it was, you could say it was manslaughter, that he didn't mean to beat her to death, it's still this horrible thing that is that happens again in later on in the story. It almost starts to happen exactly the same
And
way.
for the same reason and the same basic scene.
Well, I mean, there's more than one scene where, a woman says something that he doesn't want to hear. And I think at one point he has like a little fainting spell or maybe even a heart attack when he falls over. But like the look on his face right before, it's like, you know that he's capable of doing something really horrible and violent. And I thought it was sort of strange, like the landlady, Frau Bast, played by the actress from Ali Fear It's the Soul,
Brigitte Mira.
Bridget Mira, like she,
Who gets her door slammed in her face a record amount of times in
I
this?
love when Ava reappears and has sort of like the big scene after he has his bender and Mrs. Boss lets him in. He closes the door on Mrs. Boss' face twice in that scene. She moves from one door to another. He closes one door in her face, then walks over to the other door to the apartment that's open and closes that one in her face too. Anyway.
But like she witnesses the murder. And then like she still lets him back in the apartment and she's still kind of I thought that, like at first like is she trying to keep an eye that this doesn't happen again, but then when it almost does she sort of freezes up like the first time, but Reinhold intervenes.
But she could call for the police, she could call for help,
But
absolutely.
she also says she says, "Oh, that Franz, what a man." Like
Yeah, there's
right
something
after
special
he's been
about him.
violent.
Yeah,
And
she
what's
says like
interesting,
he's really something, yeah.
yeah, that character isn't in the book. That character was invented by Fassbender because in the book he moves from apartment to apartment. He sort of keeps bouncing around like an itinerant would, and Meck sets him up with an apartment early on in the book. He doesn't go back to where he used to live, literally.
Right.
And part of that was budgetary, is that they just wanted to have one set where they could
Yeah,
work. And
that's
this film
very
was made
television-y,
very
coming back to
cheaply.
the same
Yeah.
sets over and over again. But something about it works too by it being like the exact same place where he murdered this
Yeah.
woman, and then he beats Mitza horribly. He almost
Yeah.
smothers her to death. It's like the exact same thing happening over
Yeah.
again. And there's sort of a sense that like no matter what experiences he goes through or how close this character gets to maybe being happy, like he's not changing.
Yeah. Well, I think that that's part of what the question is. When I think about what Fassbender is interested in this book, when people are talk about like, oh, humanity is caught between good and evil, and they try and illustrate that in an artwork, normally it's a good person who's tempted by evil, right?
Yes.
That's normally what the story is that you have like a simple plan, that movie, where it's like good people who get tempted into doing something evil. This movie wants to really more concretely place him between good, his aspirations to good, and evil. And Fassbender is like, no, there is evil in him. There is real
Yes.
malice, there is real danger, there is real violence, and doesn't want to let that off the hook in any way. You know what I mean?
And for those who don't know too, like Fassbender was this was such a part of his life that Fassbender his whole body of work was taking things from this film, taking themes and even quoting direct lines. And I think what ultimately what the main thing that you can point to is the love triangle of Franz and Reinhold and Mitza being the two of them being almost kind of two sides of himself, where there's the one who can accept any kind of love and doesn't feel love in the world, and everything about him is resentful and petty and criminal. And the other one has indiscriminate love for everything in the world and has this idealized version of everyone can be part of something and everyone can have each other's babies and live together as a family, that it's okay to go out and walk the streets if you're supporting your man and going back to him and loving him. And they're two sides of Franz he can't reconcile. And that ultimately destroy each other. And at the end, what he's left with is this belief that evil has crushed good, or that, you know, love has been crushed by like the realities of the world. And that ultimately is why he can't, that we see violent tendencies in him that remind us of Reinhold. And at the same time, Reinhold stops him from killing Mietze at one point, you know, it's a complicated schism.
I mean, there's such interesting kind of foils to one another, Reinhold and Franz, because physically they seem so different. Reinhold, like Franz, he always speaks almost without a filter, it seems like. There's once or twice where he says something and it seems almost like a theatrical aside, like, you know, when he's saying, I'd never say where the burglars went after he observes a robbery, you know, from his window one night, the next day. And it seems like almost like a little aside, but then the police are like, what'd you say?
Yeah.
And then like, Reinhold, he's always kind of like holding stuff in and he stutters. Yeah. He
speaks. And Franz does like the little tongue twisters all the time, the rumble-dee, bumble-dee, dumble-dee-bee.
Right. But like, they're not so different, like, really, if you look at what they do, what they're capable
of. Oh, I think they're completely different. I think Reinhold is one of the sharpest sketches of evil ever committed to any format, novels, poetry, film. And I think that separates him from Franz, who I think when you start to get into why Fassbender is interested in this book and this movie in this era, the banalities of Franz are really important to him in contrast to the evils of Reinhold. And when you start to talk about these people are the people that became the Nazis, the Reinholds versus the Franzes, mm-hmm. and their sort of, shared death wish together, how they're tied together, I think is one of the important things. Because it's with Fassbender, what you're talking about when you talk about especially his late period work is that he starts to become obsessed with, in this movie and Lola and Maria Braun, that his parents were the Nazi generation.
Yes.
And because of the economic miracle, the post-war economic miracle, they were never called to account for what happened. And that culturally in Germany, they mm-hmm. just pushed it away. It just disappeared. And so he really is concerned with the German relationship to Nazism in a humanistic way and a political way too, but kind of delineating carefully between Reinhold's and Franz's and Mietze's, I think is something he's really concerned with. And Ava's even. This time when I watched it, you know, I'll ask you guys, who is the love of Franz's life? Is it Mietze? Or is it Ava? Or is it Mrs. Bost? Is it Mrs. Bost? Because it could also be her.
I mean, Ava's there sort of the most consistently. Mietze is sort of the big, big love, but she comes at the end and it's sort of over before you know it. Ava, like, you know, she's hurt by Franz in different ways over the course of it, but she's sort of there for him. And
she's an enabler. She's an enabler. He couldn't continue to exist without her constant help.
Well, she's the one who sets him up with Mietze, yeah, right?
All of it.
Yeah, like that's, yeah. Like what you were saying about this Nazi generation, like I even thought at the end when they say like Reinhold's sentenced to 10 years, I'm like, okay, so, like you ask the natural question that comes next is where is he going to be in 10 years? But 10 years, that's right at the beginning of the war. And I don't know, like, I mean, you could see Reinhold falling into Nazism, hypothetically, but like the Franz character, he has this sort of brief flirtation with it early on when this guy offers him a job, so that, you know, you look like a real, real German. And there's that sort of funny reveal when he's giving him this job, handing out the flyers, and you're not quite sure what it is for yet. And Franz isn't quite sure, you know, you have an inkling, but there's that reveal when he says, oh yeah, like something's missing. And he comes back and he puts the armband with the swastika on his arm. And then Franz, like, he's sort of, you know, he's a little bit embarrassed, I think, even.
Yeah.
And his friend who's selling the sausages comes by and he's like, you know, I'm Jewish, you know. And Franz is saying, well, I don't have anything against Jews, but he still kind of goes along with it. And then what's kind of funny, or, you know, in a dark sort of way, is that, you know, the group of people who pick on him for joining the Nazis, you know,
there's the communists who sing the Internationale in the bar and then stare him down.
Yeah. you know, so what he's saying, like, I believe in freedom of speech, you know, it's like a little bit funny just knowing where that ideology leads to. And then later on, he has another encounter with the communists.
But also knowing where communist ideology leads to as well. That's one thing that I think is important to consider in the context of this film, is this movie's made while Germany's still divided. You know, East Germany is still under Soviet rule. And so the connotations of communism are not, they're probably not as bad as Nazism, but they ain't good either in this film.
Yeah, when his buddy Willie, who's bad influence on him, drags him to that communist meeting, and they start saying, like, oh, you're parasite.
Oh, you're just listening to Ava and Mitza. Willie's not bad.
You don't think so? I don't know. There's something shifty about him. He's like, something about him reminds me of like Peter Lorre in Maltese Falcon, the way he's like checking his fingernails. Yeah. He's up to no good, Willie.
Obviously, the one advantage that Fassbinder had adapting the film in the 70s, adapting the book in the 70s, is that he obviously is aware of everything that happened to Germany in the last three decades, as opposed to Doblin, and has an interesting perspective on where things are headed. And I think he sets up Franz Bieberkopf as this naive person who doesn't have a political affection at all. He just kind of like has his own concerns. He doesn't believe in communism because, you know, he doesn't work. So why would he need to go out and protest? You know, why would he need to lobby in any way? And I think by the end of it, what it is he's become a nobody. You know, he's become, as they say in the movie, a new person who is like everybody in Germany at that point, is so turned so to subservience and complete apathy that of course he's going to like roll with whatever political party ends up prevailing, whatever happens in the history of Germany from that point on.
Though you never see him Sieg Heil.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's also, I think, one thing we got on, I put it on this note of like Nazism in 1928. One thing that the first time I watched this movie, I was very surprised by how little there is of that, mm-hmm. like, and that man grew up to be Elvis Presley type stuff. That like, really, he does keep most of this in the background. If anything, it's sort of a secret mm-hmm. history of anything, and that you have to sort of come with prior knowledge to get a lot of it. That it's really, the Nazism stuff is 20 minutes of, you know, the 15 and a half hours. The communist stuff is 15
minutes. Like my friend Ivan Lapshin, where there's this understanding, like, you know how bad things are going to get. We don't need to tell it to you. And that was one thing I sort of misremembered going back to watch it this time, because it's been maybe 8 or 9 years since I first saw it, to the last time I saw it. But like, I thought that sequence at the end, for some reason, I imagined it with much more kind of in your face Nazi images that really going back aren't there. It was not as much of a tonal break as I remembered.
We should mention the final sequence. It's like a 2 hour, the final episode is almost 2 hours long.
Yeah.
And it's just like dream imagery.
The other thing I misremembered was that he really, really pulls back, does not do a lot of like the old classic Weimar imagery that you would expect from a movie like this. I guess I've just read so much about that era or seen so many movies about that era. I expected more of, you know, the kind of ostentatious sort of art design and things going on in the background. Really all he does is he has the couple or so episodes of the cabaret and the Red District alley that he goes through that seems to be perpetually night with the hellish pimp, you know, Barker, you know, trying to get him to rent the Whore of Babylon.
Who it really reminded me of is Pabst. Like, I just happened to be preparing for an episode on Louise Brooks parallel to this. And so I was watching Pandora's Box and watching Diary of a Lost Girl. And like, to me, those look so much like Berlin Alexanderplatz at times, where, you know, it can be kind of confined and kind of stagey, but like, you know, there's shots of Louise Brooks in Pandora's Box where like there's that filter that gives her like little stars twinkling in her eyes and teeth and like little things like that, the framing.
Oh, eyes twinkling in this. There are tons of, there's tons of that.
Well, I was surprised by how much it looks like. There's also a 1931 version of this.
Right.
That is just normal
like
length.
Early sound
this
film.
This movie looks like that movie. When I watched that after watching this, I was surprised by how many sequences physically resemble the Fassbender sequences in a way I would have never predicted. Like the whole Franz loses his arm in it. He gets sort of duped into participating in a midnight fruit heist. And when the heat is on them, Reinhold pushes him out of the truck and he gets run over by a car and loses his arm. That sequence in the 1931 film is very similar looking to this sequence in here, although Gottfried John, who plays Reinhold, gives a very different kind of performance. So
it's another area where, like, I wish I knew the book better or at all, because the little things like the guy who comes looking for the person in the fur coat in the bar is something that recurs both in the original 1931 movie and in Fassbender's. And the bird in the cage that's in the bar in the original movie, you know, obviously kind of parallels to the bird that Mitza gives Franz as a gift throughout. Also, the two characters who play Mech
look
exactly alike.
And that guy who plays Mech in the Fassbender version, he's done like nothing else. And he's so good.
He's not one of the stable guys,
and he's in very few other movies.
And what makes that performance so good is like his remorse.
Yeah.
He kind of goes along with it. And then like, even like for the little things, like near the beginning when there's the whole episode where Franz kind of disappears from most of it and they're trying to find him. And at the end, he's saying like, well, you can come back to my place. And then like when he sees Franz again, he's so kind of guilty that he kind of stole his girlfriend, even though Franz bailed on her.
Yeah. Well, Franz does what Reinhold does later on. Franz passes her off to his friend because he's sick of her. You know, even though he does it in a more subconscious and roundabout way. But that's one of the ways in which I think Fassbender is trying to illustrate the idea of behaviors don't have a concrete moral value, that there's something beyond the action itself that creates a moral value.
Right. I mean, that's what I was trying to say earlier, that there is something similar with Franz and Reinhold, even though their personalities and like so much about them seems different, but it's hard to point like, oh, is there like something that Reinhold does that Franz doesn't also do or is capable of? You know, Reinhold seems like evil incarnate and Franz doesn't, but at the same time, there's really nothing that Franz
can be accused of that you can't accuse Reinhold of, and vice versa.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yes.
Well, not only Franz, because this is one reason that you can't like dismiss the first third of the miniseries, which I'm guessing is, you know, it reflects the first third of the book, where we have things like we have a proto Reinhold in Looters.
Who
ends up abusing his relationship with Franz and blackmails this poor widow. And then, of course, later on, they're directly connected in the last 2 hour hallucinatory scene where he sees them both as like kind of devilish figures at the same time, and things that that recur later on as well. I mean, not only like Chris was saying, not only the shoving off of Lena onto to Mech, which is the same thing that he'll end up, the same relationship he'll end up having with Reinhold later on when the real story kicks in, but things that happen with Ava that are going to be important later on. And the idea, I think, too, and this might be like a simplistic take, Germany coming out of World War One and then ended up going back into World War II, mm-hmm. which will be just as economically devastating as, you know, if not more so. The same idea that, like, he comes out of prison and then the same mistakes are going to be made, the same things are going to be happening. So we see then this earlier things are that go on kind of establish his character, but kind of set up things that are going to happen later on in the story that you feel he should have learned from those experiences. Like he shouldn't have befriended Reinhold when after his experience with Looters. I think the real problem with Bieberkopf's philosophy of life and his naivete and his standing away from everything is that he's not going to recognize things that should make him change or make him understand the world better.
It's like when Mitza says to him, "You're making yourself unhappy." And I think that all of that stuff, it's important to think about Mitza and not just Reinhold in this context, is that one of the things I was really struck by with Mitza this time is that with her, the value and meaning of actions shift. So like getting drunk with her, getting drunk, we've just had, there's the fourth episode in the series, he goes on a bender and just completely descends into the depths of alcoholism. But then with Mitsa, when they get drunk, there's that very long playful scene of them drinking. So it goes from being the rock bottom of his life to getting drunk, but just like things that you would think have one meaning take on a different meaning with her. Like when he gives her the money, like he earns the marks and gives it to her, and she's furious because she doesn't want him working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's the one who works. And like, if you think about that in an objective way, like giving the person you love money so they don't have to work anymore as a prostitute should be an objectively good thing. But its value shifts with her, you know, sleeping with Eva, the beating is different than the beating he gives Ida, his first girlfriend that he kills, that he goes to jail for. The actions, the values, the moral values and meanings of their things with Mitsa all sort of shift. Or like when she gets the letter from her lover and she thinks it's funny. Like objectively, like that should be a devastating thing. In a melodrama, that's a devastating thing. But here it's an inconsequential thing, you know?
Well, it's funny, like, you compare it to melodrama, because I was thinking how the form is so much like a melodrama in that, like, a melodic drama where the music is driving it and it has these big emotions and, like, the performances are a little bit theatrical, like, there's a bigness to them. I was watching some of the behind-the-scenes sequences and just watching on, like, a little video camera, you sort of realize the facial gestures, the movements are so much bigger than what you would go for naturalism. So, like, it's kind of interesting as a heightened drama, you know, it's hard to find a part in the film where like there's not music actually, like there's music almost constantly trying to underscore the emotions of these scenes and trying to make them bigger.
I think also trying to, because it's low budget, he tries to paper over some of the more boring scenes where they've only done one take and haven't done coverage and can't cut around. Yeah. And they just sort of try and paper over it with the music. And I think the score is lovely, and I think it ends up working most of the time.
Visually, too, I think partly because, you know, it does have sort of a restricted budget, especially for something so ambitious. And, you know, because it's shot for 25 frames per second for European television, I would guess Fassbinder didn't want it to look like just TV. So it's like almost every visual trick in the book thrown at this thing to just make it not boring. All these things separating you from the characters. There's reflective surfaces, there's smoke, there's a glitter, there's flashing lights, there's I heard they were using nylon stretched over the lens, which is a trick I ripped off a lot from my early films.
Well, it was his first movie he shot with Xaver Schwarzenberger, and Schwarzenberger said they actually made a bunch of mistakes. And this movie, I think you can see, especially in comparison, it is a huge shift in style for Fassbender, and where he ends up going with Schwarzenberger is to the heavily stylized, like, Veronica Voss, Corel stuff at the very end of his career there.
Right.
I think that they luck into a lot of stuff with this movie, and like Schwarzenberger said, when it showed on German television, all of the blacks look green, so they regretted trying to put so much black in the frame to hide hide some of the sets, and that they regretted having the darkness dominate the first half of the movie. I don't know if you noticed, but it's almost all nighttime and interior nighttimes until Mitsa appears, and then it's suddenly daylight. Even in the apartment, they lit it for daylight. And there's a lot, I agree that I think they threw a ton of stuff at it, and were sort of lucky that it worked out as well as it did. And I think when you see the refined take, the longer they work together, that the later films, I think they get it better. Like, I think Lola and Veronica Voss are sort of children of this movie that they really nail it with.
How crazy is it that this was their first collaboration? Like, hey, nice to meet you. Would you like to embark on the biggest thing I've ever done that's going to revolutionize television and film?
Well, they said the first mistake is they shot on 16 because they were worried about budget. And he didn't realize that Fassbender gets stuff in very few takes, that most of them were single take shots. And he would have done 35 if they knew he needed so little coverage and so little retake money.
Right. I heard the shooting ratio was about 2 to 1. And if you watch like some of the behind the scenes, like they'll do like one third of a take, and then he'll stop it immediately if he sees like something's not working.
And he doesn't shoot for coverage. A lot of the shots are designed to be up there without editing.
Yeah. Yeah. In like that does give it like sort of a theatrical quality sometimes.
Let me make clear, I think it looks great and plays great. It sounds like I'm being critical, but it's more like,
of course,
it's more like, hey, a lot of artists take credit for happy mistakes, you know, like they were intentional. I think this movie is a bunch of happy mistakes that all worked out great.
Sure. I mean, there's even like equipment showing up in some of the shots. There's the, you know, of course, the scene where he's beating Mitsa, there's like a pretty prominent C-stand just like sticking in the corner, but like you're so emotionally invested. First time I watched it, I didn't think of that or didn't notice that you're so absorbed, you know, but like you can, it does kind of get away with stuff because it's got so much going on visually and emotionally.
Can I ask John a question? Because John and I are both big Fassbender fans, and I know we sort of have a little bit of a disagreement on later period Fassbender where he likes it more than you. John, do you prefer this style to his earlier style, like this kind of stockings over the lens, or do you just... Because you're more forgiving of Corell and Veronica Voss than I am, which I think are bad movies. Like, what do you... Talk to me about the style, John, because we've never... You and I have never talked about that, and I'm curious.
I like Lola.
I love Lola.
Yeah, I was going to say, when I think of that style, I think of Lola mainly, and, like, what amazing achievement that film is. And I think that the problems with Veronica Voss and Corell are not specifically tied into that approach to the films. I think it's... something different. Do I prefer it? I definitely like his mid-period films the best, and that approach the best, where it's a very kind of earthy sort of feel to it, and it's not, there aren't a lot of bells and whistles. And I think that Fassbender throughout his career relied on the size of emotion in his films. I think that he's a lot more interested in capturing the characters and the actors than he is about putting up lots of lights and having that. And maybe that has something to do with why Alexander Platz doesn't have lots of scenes of the Baroque and the cabarets and the kind of the extravagance that he could have put on there. He has no problems going back to the same sets over and over again and having just two characters in the scene, because what he's trying to capture is that emotional moment between them more than anything else. And I think you get that mostly in his best films, which to me are Fear Eats the Soul or Merchant of Four Seasons, the ones that he makes in the middle of his career, before he kind of moved into sort of more political ideas and then into his more visual ones like we're talking about now. So I appreciate everything about his career, and I like all the different stages, but personally, no, I don't prefer it to the earlier stuff, except for the very earlier stuff.
Well, Chris, you wrote a paper, or you wrote a little piece on Berlin Alexander Platz where you sort of mentioned something that kind of stuck out in my mind, where you said Werner Fassbinder, he's maybe a great filmmaker without a clear magnum opus, you know, and that it's more the cumulative effect of his body of work. And like some of the films, like I think, like, you know, Fox and His Friends or Ellie Fury, it's the
Fox
Soul,
and His
but,
Friends,
you know,
where what's just... the name main character named in Fox and His Friends?
Franz Bieberkopf.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a few things that you can see from Berlin Alexander Platz appear before in his films, you know, or like even that there's the scene in Ali Fear It's the Soul when they go and have lunch and then there's all the people staring. Like there's a very, very similar scene in Berlin Alexanderplatz where it's just after he beat Mitsa and she's full of bruises and they go and sit down and people are staring. Like it's kind of the same scene, the way it's shot and the kind of that extreme sort of weight of embarrassment. So
it's
like
the same kind of chairs.
Same kind of chairs, those yellow chairs, and it does feel like you said, you know, him kind of building up to this.
Oh, even his early movies, Love is Colder Than Death and Gods of the Plague, have that like three, that love triangle and that betrayal, which at the end of Love is Colder Than Death is a car, right? It's like them getting out of the heist and then she leaves them behind. Yeah. It's that same sort of thing where of like Franz getting pushed out of the car.
Like sometimes ideas show up and they do kind of feel like rough drafts for other films that he'd make.
Well, clearly at the pace he worked, he can't afford to be a perfectionist, and that I think that a lot of his movies do have a sloppiness about them that I don't think that's a discredit to them at all, but it's like he makes movies that have C-stands randomly in the shot and feature a performance that maybe something could have been done about, especially when he's still working with the anti-theater people, where they will occasionally like make noises or play a line in a certain way that's like, oof, like what? So has somebody give that one another shot where they sort of like, it's funny because Barbara Sakawa is the only one in this movie that I feel like gives a really anti-theater type performance where it's like she'll scream randomly and like stamp her feet and like squeak and squeal and like go from like kabuki poses, and that I associate with the earlier stuff a lot.
I always have this feeling when I think like both times I've watched it where like I kept sort of expecting like, okay, drop the act, Mitsa, like you're not actually that childlike, or like I always expect her to be like more mature and putting on something of an act.
But she does in the big scene with Reinhold. That's what I was struck by this time.
That's true. Yeah.
She is sort of street smart, and when she needs to put that guard up,
right,
she's
right.
actually very smart about having her guard up, which emphasizes sort of the insane purity of her love for Franz.
Something that I think distinguishes two of these later films, and for me, like the big kind of dress rehearsal for this was one of his more underrated films, Bullweiser. Also known as The Station Master's Wife, which is also shot for television.
I've never seen it.
It's hard to see.
Yeah. I've got like a couple holes in the filmography I still need to
Oh, really?
Plug,
out of the 500 movies he made, there's TV movies and short films.
But I think his earlier career is more people turning to look at each other and people having reactions to each other. And his later period is defined a little bit more by people looking through windows or looking through glass, you know, mirrors or glass, whatever, yeah. These foggy, you know, kind of like arty wall, mirror yeah. walls. That
I felt like Nora Helmer was a dry run in the
and
same
it's a lot
way.
More self-reflective.
That's the way Nora Helmer is shot, where it's like,
oh yeah, yeah absolutely,
Nora Helmer's
yeah.
an adaptation of A Doll's House, and it's basically all one set, and he moves the camera as much as he moves it in Chinese Roulette, and he finds like every single thing in the world to shoot the shot through, like lattice works and interior windows and plants and like glass tabletops. He just like keeps putting things between the characters and the camera, like John has mentioned.
Exactly. And you don't think of that when you think of a movie like Fear Eats the Soul or Merchant
no,
of Four
visually
Seasons.
They're a little bit more I guess you could say plain or stripped down. Yeah.
But I like that about those films. But I do think that he doesn't a lot of people want to call this his masterpiece, and I genuinely think the only reason for that is because it's so long. Like, you know...
Right, because of the
it's
scope.
A, it's
yeah.
a phenomenal film. He has a lot of phenomenal films, you know? But I think that it's hard to pick any one of them and elevate them decisively above the others. The way when you watch Citizen Kane and Lady mm-hmm. from Shanghai back-to-back, well, one is clearly better than the other, you know? When you watch Vertigo next to Trouble with Harry, it's like, yeah.
Let me ask you, Chris, about its length, because I know you've seen it both. You've watched it over periods of time, and you had the one experience where you got to see it over two nights in a theater. So what do you think about the correct viewing experience of this movie?
Oh, that's always the question with this movie, isn't it? I think that what I decided after watching it, well, you rented it in college when we lived together, and you watched it fairly compressed. And John and I lived in the same apartment, and I wandered in and out of that and would catch up on episodes. Like, I would back up and find episodes that I had missed while John was watching it, and I'm not sure I caught it all then. Then I watched it at MoMA. MoMA showed it over 2 days, one weekend. It was, you know, 7.5 hours a day each day, and they would, like, show two episodes, take a short break, show another two episodes, have a break for lunch, then come back and show two more at night. They did that over 2 days. And then this time I watched it, like, an episode here and there where when I felt like it. And I do really think that reading it the way you would read a book is the way to do it. That you would read, you never have a plan to sit down and read the book Berlin Alexander Platz all in one sitting. That's crazy, or in two sittings. You would sit and read as much as you wanted to, a couple chapters, and then stop when you got to a natural stopping point or when you were tired. And I think that that's the way to actually do it. I don't think optimal experience would be watching one episode a week the way it originally aired, especially because a lot of episodes end mid-scene, mid-sentence, you know, and pick right back up where they left off. And he builds all of those. Every episode ends on a little climax. It's never that brutal, but there are episodes that pick up exactly, literally the exact frame they left off on. And then also, watching it this time, I'm not sure that he intends the episodes to breaks, that he means them at just each hour as
right,
an episode
sometimes
breaks.
The titles appear like halfway through,
yeah,
some
half
of
an
them.
Hour
you
in.
Know, it feels like, oh, this is the new chapter starting. It's like the other episode where it started and ended isn't quite where the chapter of the narrative started and ended.
Yeah, like one chapter is 45 minutes, one chapter is an hour and a half.
Yeah, because other than the bookend episodes, they're all exactly an hour long, pretty much.
Watching it over the weekend, let me just say, the one thing that I got from watching it over the weekend, it was watched it at MoMA with Eric Frender, our good buddy who writes for the Pink Smoke. We just did the Jean-Pierre Melville episode of Wrong Reel with them.
Fantastic episode. I like that one.
It was a torrential rainstorm. Everything in the theater was soaking wet. Like, everybody came in with wet feet. There's one bathroom down there in MoMA with a single toilet and a single urinal that it was, like, annihilated. It was, like, a gross, mind-melting experience. And it was raining so much you didn't want to go out and grab lunch during the break because you would just get soaked again. And so I genuinely, it was just, like, I spent all this time in MoMA. And also, like, we somehow found a way to stay awake and alert all weekend. So I was like having a psychotic break by the time the final hallucination episode came on. And the final hallucination episode played for me like getting induced into a cult. It felt like, holy shit, I'm seeing the face of God right now. Like, I can't fucking, you're right on, Fassbender. Like, everybody, we gotta leave this theater and tell them how to stop Nazism in the past. Like, if we just control our minds, we can, you know, it was like, I think that final episode packs a huge punch if you turn watching the movie into an endurance test, but I don't think the movie is intended like Tarkovsky or Bellatar, where the expansion of time is intended as an aesthetic element. I think it's incidental to what he's trying to do.
You can almost feel the narrative accelerate as you watch on. So, like, I think, you know, maybe somebody getting into it, they might watch the first episode on its own, and then a day or two later watch two episodes, and then three or four in a row, and then watch it to the end. Like, you could almost see it, like, accelerating. Like, that's the impression I had while watching it, is, like, it got easier to get to become sucked into the story as, you know, things kind of seem very loose at the beginning, but there is kind of a cause and effect where this leads to this, which leads to this, and, you know, kind of snowballs to that big climax you mentioned. I mean, John, what was your experience watching it for the first time or rewatching it, just how you approached it?
Well, I should mention that the first time I ever heard of it, of course, was on the show The Critic, where he makes the joke. He makes the joke, son, how would you feel about renting the 15 and a half hour Berlin Alexanderplatz in his sunsets again? And I think, you know, its length is, you know, what everyone knows about it before they know anything about the story, or that it's based on a famous book, or that it's the culmination of Fassbender's career in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You know, they know that
it's one of those
long
movies like Satan Tango and Hitler, a film from Germany, and Out One.
Right. I mean, there's always something like a little bit alluring about those films. Like, some of them were like really hard to find for a long time.
Yeah, no shit.
Berlin Alexanderplatz was like a little bit easier to get a hold of. And like, I wonder too if like it did set a precedent for, like, I know Bellatar likes Rainer Werner Fassbender very much. So, like, you know, if he's like, oh, like, I can adapt a book and just make it as long as it needs to be. But yeah, like, you know, for, I remember like years, like Out One, I'm like, well, you know, this mysterious thing, like, what could it be? And then like, it's so, you know, of course it's comparable in length, but it's like so different from Berlin Alexanderplatz, where it's this like free.
Yeah. My experience with Out One was I worked so hard to find a copy of it. Like, I spent a lot of money. I spent several hundred dollars on a copy of it. 20 minutes in was like, oh, mother. Fucker, god damn it. Just like, like, I'm sure that movie is for some people, but it is, you could not make a movie that is less for Chris Funderburg. And it was just like, dumb hippies, like, putting on performances of their own life, like, oh, get out of my way. Sorry, John.
Well, what if Zabriskie point was 15 hours long?
But nothing happened in it.
I mean, I like Out One, but like, there's nothing to compare it to Berlin Alexanderplatz, like, other than the length. And it, like, I feel like,
well, Decalogue. I think Decalogue is a good
Decalogue is a good. Yeah, well, like, a lot of television, like, I think, like, you know, historically, like, television, you know, could be sort of writer driven, and now it's mostly producer driven, but once in a while you do have like a director come in and it's like their TV project, you know, and it's like a long form film, and Decalogue is of course like that, and you know, there's a few other instances. So I was saying to you guys earlier that
Decalogue is a lot easier to
because you know, it's individual narratives, or like the you know, it's considerably shorter, but like the Todd Haynes, Mildred Pierce, I think is clearly, you know, him saying like, oh, I can do it, you know, a little bit like my own Berlin Alexanderplatz.
And obviously Haynes is a huge Fassbinder fan. I think the difference that you have to think about is that adapting Berlin Alexanderplatz for Fassbinder was a way of dealing with, you know, an expansive narrative. Whereas Haynes took what is a, I think, what, 100-page, 110-page book by James M. Cain and really expanded it to his own ends, to like to really like delve into those characters in that story. So he wasn't kind of doing it because he had to. I think it was more of like he was kind of specifically taking that Fassbinder, like that treatment of like going in there and really like giving it something, giving it the old Haynes, you know.
Right. Well, I mean, like, you could theoretically compress the Berlin Alexanderplatz narrative, and that's what the first movie does, the 1930s one, but like it felt so rapid fire. I was like, wait, like he just got run over, and now there's Mitza, and now she's dead. Like, what? No, it's over. Yeah. You know, it goes by so fast, especially once you sort of go through all these scenes in Berlin Alexanderplatz, and there's so much emotion and depth. And
those recurrences of behavior. Like, I think that's what the huge thing is that by the time you get to the end and you see that hallucinatory finale, that last 2 hours, and you're seeing all these characters from the beginning of the miniseries that have been gone for, you know, hours, and you're like, oh yeah, and you're remembering all this, and you're connecting these things in interesting ways. You know, I think that's sort of the power of having this be a 15 and a half hour thing, where you're kind of going back to the beginning and thinking about things that you'd forgotten about, you know, once the Reinhold story kicks in.
We should also mention that the book is a very traditional piece of modern literature. It gets compared to James Joyce a lot, which I think is a bad comparison for it, but it has a lot of different people's sort of rambling internal monologues. There's a lot of like songs, like the lyrics written down in it, and it'll take like times to just like a news reprint a newspaper article, and it's like a collage of things. As a book, the book is not like James M. Cain, just to point out. The book is more like, it actually reminded me of like a inferior version of Brock's The Sleepwalkers.
Oh, that's great.
I think for me, for Fassbinder's film, one of the big touchstones that the Fassbinder's film reminds me of The Sleepwalkers actually more than it does Brock's book, especially the last section of The Sleepwalkers. Sleepwalkers is three sections that are 15 years apart. It's 1887, 1902, and 1917 in Germany. And the final section of Brock's book has a ton in common with Fassbinder's movie. And Dublin's book feels very informed by the German modernists before him, by like Brock and Musil and those type of people.
So much of what I think makes this great is the aspects that like you can't really do in a novel. Like, you know, we talked about earlier having the flashback with the, you know, this pleasant description or text from the novel while he's showing you visually, you know, this flashback, what she's done, like things like that. You know, it gives it sort of this extra sting, or like, you know, we talked about this sort of visual quality, like,
yeah, he resists the novel overtly at times, like when Lena goes to give the pornography back to the guy, when Franz has his job at the newspaper stand and the newspaper guy's like, do you want to sell pornography? And he reads some of it to Lena, who's like, oh my God, you're gay. And he's like, what? No, I just think this is a beautiful story. And she goes and throws it in like the newspaper guy's face. There's a description from the book that's like, and she passed by the liquor store and right in front of such and such hat shop, but we see something completely different on screen, and her performance is different than what the book describes. So there are frequently moments where he reminds you, like, there's also this book that I'm taking from that's different than what I'm showing you. And he does that a lot of times in the film, where the what's happening in the description doesn't match up precisely with what he's put on screen.
Right.
And even the, like, my dream of the title of the epilogue is my dream, the dream of Franz Bieberkopf by Alfred Dobbin, you know, where he's like, this is my dream of that.
He couldn't not Fassbinder it up. I think, like, he kind of experimented with sort of elliptical narrative before. Martha feels very much like that, where its characters kind of stepping out of their scene, you know, and there's a lot of sort of Brechtian distancing to going on there as well.
Fassbender talks about he read it when he was in, what's the phrase he uses? Going through a murderous puberty.
Oh my God.
When he was 14 or 15. And it just really, the Reinhold and Franz relationship struck him at a moment when his sexuality was sort of starting to want to break itself free from societal constraints. And obviously, you know, a lot of this gets lost now and I feel like cultures move so much that it gets sort of forgotten that so much of like homosexual culture was like encrypted, you know, that you had to decode it. And it was only understood by people who were gay that this has a homosexual meaning. Mm-hmm. And I think he read a homosexual meaning as a teenager into that book that is not necessarily there. I think their connection is more between Reinhold and Franz is intended to be more doomed and less like, they're in love. And I think mm-hmm. that Fassbender projects a ton of more actual homosexual thoughts and feelings onto the book and the characters than there are in the book. And he did when he was a kid, so whenever he reads it and rethinks about the book and then goes to adapt it himself, that becomes the most important stuff in it. You know what I mean?
It's also that their relationship is a very kind of, is a duality where they recognize things of each other within themselves.
Yeah.
And that Reinhold like is such a self-hating guy that ultimately what he wants to do, he looks down at Bieberkopf as like an idiot, like a dummy.
Like one of my favorite scenes, it's the first time Franz goes to see him after he had his arm run over, and you know Reinhold's like waiting for him to accuse him, or like he just gets so uncomfortable with like how not even forgiving Franz is, he's just accepting that like, oh hey Reinhold, you know,
I
like...
love how he opens the door, sees it's Franz, and then closes the door and reopens it with the gun.
He's put away the gun, Reinhold.
That he slowly realizes that not only is he not going to be, you know, killed in a like a revenge or anything, but that he has such a hold over Franz. He can ask to see his, like, you know, missing arm. He can, you know, basically do something that's going to make him very uncomfortable because he has that much control over the relationship.
Well, I mean, that scene has, like, a very sort of sexual quality in that, like, you know, hey, let me see something private of yours. And it's, like, looking at this appendage. And, you know, that's the only person I think he shows it to, right?
Yeah. You know, that he shows the something.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, it feels, like, very sort of private and intimate. And, like, he's kind of repulsed but also attracted. Like, I think that's definitely... in that scene, I would guess.
But Reinhold is going to still ultimately, you know, commit the same kind of crime as Franz and mm-hmm. end up going about it just as impulsively and idiotically as Franz would. You know, those characters are just intertwined in such a way that, like, they don't recognize that they are practically the same person, just kind of looking down at each other, and that it's like a self-hatred. I think that in Reinhold, who does everything very methodically and thinks that everything he does has a certain meaning, whereas Franz is, you know, doesn't. You know, Franz is just kind of like beating his own drum.
The only difference between Franz Bieberkopf and Reinhold is an egg beater. No, I agree with that. I actually agree completely with what John is saying. But just on the, in terms of the subtext, too, it's interesting. Dublin was Jewish, and like, I think in like the early 40s, he converted to Christianity, which is a very weird sort of life path. And I think that the book is thinking really more in terms of good and evil than anything else, whereas Fassbender's big theme throughout his career and that he seizes on, especially in the early episodes of this film, is that political health is related to sexual health, and that political functionality is related to healthy functioning sexuality, and that there's a sexual component to politics in all ways. And I think that that's something when you have like, because the early episodes of this book have them like reading the newspaper ads and the essays about like a healthy gonad and to like improve your stamina.
And then the newspapers start having stories about like, oh, this like, you know, Jewish child molester is uncaught, and like those filter in.
God, how many times does the phrase Jewish child molester apprehended get said in that scene? Just the newspaper boy yelling it over and over. One thing that I also thought was fascinating this time, just on the subject of like vile crime, the 1929, John, you got Peter Curtin in Dusseldorf, and you have in both the book and the movie, Franz bites all of the women's necks. That's like his erotic move, as he pulls them close and bites their necks. Peter Curtin was the serial killer who was known as the Vampire of Dusseldorf, who in 1928 and 1929 was the...
Fassbinder produced the film about him, right? Tenderness of Wolves?
Oh, I've never seen it, actually. I didn't realize that was about Curtin.
Okay, yeah.
It's like the person who inspired the killer in M, right?
Yes, yeah.
Fassbinder didn't direct it, but it's very...
Oh,
like,
is
it
the one that
in.
Kurt Robb directed, or Uli Lommel did one of them?
Yeah, it's directed by Lommel, and Kurt Robb stars in it.
Yeah, I have actually seen that, but that was way, way long time ago. But it's sort of, it's funny to connect him to those behaviors as well, that sort of the sexual dysfunction, because that was really two things that were invented around this time. Or came to sort of cultural consciousness that sort of crystallized the zeitgeist were psychiatry, which the book is really obsessed with. And then also you see the serial murder at the same time. And then for Fassbinder to have the 70s more the Lacanian take, you know, that I think he rejects a bit on psychiatry and sexual serial murder, sort of tying that into his political ideas in his era.
But the sort of sexual exuberance of the Weimar era was kind of legendary, and also not just, straight sexuality, but queer sexuality. You see it all through the films,
legendary.
And very often it's tied to murder, you know.
No, legendary. Have you not seen
The Entertainment?
Sexuality of the Weimar era was legendary. Sorry.
You know, but like it's famous, like all the queer bars that existed, and like that was part of like what the Nazism was a response to. It's like, hey, we gotta clean this up, and you know, there was the degenerate artwork, the so-called degenerate artwork that was, you know, it
Alexander
was famous,
Platz
and then
was
like there was
them.
This strong backlash, you know, you would run into or like come across people who would say like, oh yeah, like, you know, Nazism was bad, but like we'd never had crime during that time, and it's like you had the worst crimes ever, but you know, that was people's impression, is that like, oh, they cleaned things up.
Well, that's what's funny about Doblin's book, is that it has a little bit of the what is crime anyway, what is evil attitude, not knowing what will come right down the pike. And his book ends on one of the last things it says about Franz is he, in reference to the security guard job, he accepts there is nothing more to say about his life, which when you read that after World War II, it's like, oh really, there's nothing. It's such a prophetically like nobody sees it coming, even in 1929. And I think that's one thing that's interesting to consider about the context for this film is the Nazi party was waning in 1929, that they got out of, Hitler gets out of prison. He seizes control of the Nazi party in the 25 or 26 elections. They do very small percent, like 3%. In the 28 election,
no,
in
they were
the 28,
a fringe group.
That
they
number
were
goes
not...
down.
Yeah.
Like, they were trending downward, and they were really marginal when this book was written and set, and that economically, because of the Dawes plan, at that moment, things had really stabilized in Germany, and it's only the Depression in 1930 that causes the explosion in the Nazi Party's popularity. And in 1930 elections, that's where they become the second most successful group electorally, and that they're a super fringe group even in 29.
And when I said before that that he kind of tempers himself on the Weimar era imagery, that kind of stuff, I guess what I meant to say was he kind of saves it all for the last two hours, where there's so much crazy stuff going on and a lot more religious imagery than Fassbinder normally puts into a movie.
I mean, it's done, like, I almost found, like, tongue-in-cheek.
Oh, it's very, very tongue-in-cheek. But, again, that's very kind of uncharacteristic for Fassbinder.
I mean, that
kind of thing from Fellini.
Some of the imagery in that segment did kind of remind me. I almost thought, like, going back and watching it now, I probably like blended it in my memory a little bit with Hitler, a film from Germany, where there's also sort of the projected backgrounds and puppets. And like, for some reason, like I think I got like contamination in my memory of both films.
Oh,
but like,
yeah.
it had sort of a similar quality, I thought, when I was just rewatching it now. But
for me, like, what I take from that final 2 hours is probably not intended at all, but that Margaret Carstensen plays one of the two angels. And for me, like, the Hannah Saigula, Margaret Carstensen dynamic in his filmography is one of the most fascinating things about it. How Saigula's characters are almost sort of untouchable, you know, for the most part, that she's almost like a regal in her, you know, even when she's playing a prostitute or someone who's kind of put upon, you get this feeling that, you know, there's this classiness to her that Fassbender himself would never do anything to strike out against her, to harm her. Whereas Margaret Carstensen is like his moving target constantly, right? She's like gets abused. She begs for abuse. Like it's a non-ending suffering for her and her characters within Fassbender's filmography. And I almost like to think that this, her being an angel, it's the last time that they work together, this finale of Berlin Alexanderplatz. I like to think that she's had her redemption. She's an angel now. You know, she's moved. She's not even part of the narrative.
There's a lot of familiar faces in this. Like, you know, a lot of his regulars are there.
Definitely has his, like, hey, guy's going to be introduced getting beaten up. Of course, that's going to be Volker Spengler. Hey, we need a brittle woman to be treated like garbage. Get me Irm Herman. You know, like, he has them playing like the most Fassbender roles too, in most instances.
Spengler looks a little bit like Judge Doom in this movie.
It's true.
But there's even like Gunther Kaufmann shows up in it as one of the Pum's gangsters, you know, yeah. Like there's, you know, all that.
Of course, and Gunther Kaufmann's, you know, very significantly is the one holding Franz in like a headlock in the finale.
Part of the hallucination.
Since Gunther Kaufmann, of course, was Fassbender's Karen from Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant, you know, his original tormentor. That seems very appropriate.
Yeah.
I was thinking back to something you said just like a little bit earlier, but like one phrase I've kind of gotten sick of this past year is, you know, that actually has some parallels to today. And like, I was thinking like how universal some of these things are.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one thing that's particularly funny in light of today. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's things in this movie that I don't know if you're like a very, I want to stay away from any inflammatory words, but like a politically correct millennial, what this movie reads like to, because there's like an amount of, one of his themes is the complicity of victims in their own subjugation. Mm-hmm. That's something Fassbender's interested in over and over, is how people play a role in their own misery, play a role in their own bad relationships, play a role in their own political subjugation. And like, victim blaming is like one of those code red, you know,
yeah,
like
big
things
alert,
you can't
yeah.
even bring up.
Sure.
And then also the scene where you have the communists who they see the Nazi in the bar and they're going to punch that Nazi in the face. And that scene is all about how ridiculous the communists are.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Like how silly and absurd it is. And in the context of Germany in the 70s, of course, like, yeah, you know, the communists, the anti-fascists, the people who did the Internationale, they're not the goal. They're not any better. They accomplished nothing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, they're a problem too. And I think in this movie that parallels today, there's a lot of parallels today, but I think that also, like, a lot of good artworks that has irony and humanity and empathy for
right.
all characters and all things in it, it undermines a lot of the, like, what you might think the political perspective of a movie is when you hear, like, radical gay queer filmmaker and the making a movie about the rise of Nazi Germany
right,
or whatever.
Right.
This movie gets portrayed as...
Well, I mean, if you wanted to do, like, the like, thinly veiled, where, like, all the characters are clearly, like, stand-ins, and, like, oh, like, Reinhold is, like, a stand-in for Hitler, like, that, I think, would have been a more boring movie, you
yeah.
know? It, like, you
Without
could
a doubt.
Make a very, like, straightforward, like, oh, and, like, he's
yeah.
corrupted. And,
but there isn't,
like,
but there's an interesting, there's an interesting running, and it's all, like, background details that I noticed this time. There's, like, Fassbender's political essay analysis on what happened, because there's all the lines about how, like, Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg aren't here anymore, who, and they were the heads of the German Communist Party, who were killed during the 1919 uprising, right? So you have all this talk about how there's sort of no head to the leftist resistance in the country. And then there's a bunch of stuff about the Dawes Plan, which was this thing that was in the mid-20s, I think like 24, that was designed to ameliorate the hyperinflation that had plagued post-Treaty of Versailles Germany. And it worked. Right? And it sort of created stability. And then there's posters advertising, I think it's a speech, it was hard for me to translate, by Karl von Schitzky, who was another person like Dawes who won the Nobel Peace Prize. He was convicted of treason in Germany in 1931. His whole thing was that he discovered that the Germans were rearming and engaging in rearmament, training troops in Russia, right? And he discovered that and was tried for treason, and all of his reporting was on that. So in the background, you have his analysis of like the quibbling between the social democrats and the communists. And you can sort of see the way this thing's it unfolds is that leftist resistance gets cut off at the knees in 1919. Dawes Plan stabilizes hyperinflation. German begins to rearm. And that like his sort of analysis isn't, we didn't punch enough Nazis in the face. His analysis is much more complicated than that as far as politically. And it feels almost like he just has to nod at the like, well, this is what happened, is there was a depression and there was unemployment and that was there, you know, and though these things are the explanation, but I'm not concerned with the explanation. The explanation is simple. I'm concerned with the people inside it and sort of the moral human quality of everything that's going down.
Well, I keep thinking this whenever I run into films that people describe as very philosophical or very political. Like, it only sort of interests me in as much as it kind of applies to people. Like, what does that philosophy mean for a person? Or what does that political point of view mean for people? Like, sometimes I feel like that element, it's kind of excluded. And, you know, you could look at Berlin Alexanderplatz through a human understanding of things, if that makes sense.
It does. But I think there's also, like, when you consider this movie in terms of theodicy, where, you know, the big question is, you know, why does God allow evil to exist? If God is real and just, how does the Holocaust happen, right? And since Doblin's book is very concerned with that question of why does evil exist in the world with a just God, it ends up being a very harmonic convergence as far as addressing that question. You know what I mean?
Right.
And sort of, and his answers are more complicated than, you might expect. I think that that's one of the things where, one of the times when it's showing the reenactment of the murder, a flashback to the murder, it plays the entire, the voiceovers, the parallel is just the Abraham and Isaac. You know, that story where
Abraham
has got to take his son and God commands him to take his son out to the desert and murder him. And it's a very touching and upsetting retelling of the story. It's not just quoting the Bible directly. It's like an imagination of that story. And it's very upsetting virgin.
Yes.
It brings again the kind of victimizer situation, because isn't Abraham asking, convincing Isaac to allow himself to be sacrificed
that
in that
retelling?
It won't
work unless you, unless you agree to it. You know, and then God...
Unless you let me kill you.
And then God says, hallelujah, you are obedient. And I think that that's, you know, obviously Kierkegaard wrote all about fear and trembling is all about this parable. And like, how can you not be terrified of living in a world where that's what God asks of you, where God asks you to murder your firstborn son for no reason, you know? And I think that that this movie goes to those classics of the Bible that deal with, you know, there's also in the fourth episode all the stuff about the book of Job, you know, which are the classic why does God let bad things happen stories, you know, and
because don't ask questions.
Well, the book of Job is so weird in real life.
I love it. Because
it's the only time Satan is in the Bible.
Well, I mean, the basic story for anyone who doesn't know, it's God makes a deal with the devil that, you know, this person only has faith in God because God's given them all this great stuff. So it's like God, kills his stock, kills his slaves, covers him in boils,
leaves him sitting on the dung sheet
on a bet with the devil, covered
in boils, scratching himself with a potsherd, and then he curses God. So God loses the bet with the devil, and God comes down and is like, "Who the fuck
God's
are you?
Pissed.
Did you make the heaven and the skies? Did you beat back Leviathan?" And just like yells at him, like, "Who are you to complain?
Who are you
asshole?
To question?" But like the what I always thought was really interesting,
very
like
Fassbender-esque.
The history of the word Satan, like the word Shatan, like it means opposition, almost like legal opposition. So
like the accuser, like in court.
Yeah, well, like I mean, there's a whole character who kind of like, "Oh yeah, I'm Satan." When he meets Franz, that's a very sort of unusual scene, that the man who comes back near the end with the beard, I don't think he's like so much of a stand-in for a Satan character, but he is kind of like an opposition to France, where he's at in his life.
Talking about the sexy Lincoln,
the
guy who has the Lincoln beard, right?
The man with the beard.
The Mennonite character. He's presented as being like someone who like heals him when he initially goes into his suicidal drunken stupor, and then he's in his corner in the boxing ring in the green screen rotating shot in the final 2 hours. So is he a devil character, or is he kind of a devil on the shoulder?
He reminded me of also because of the way of he looks like Gregory Peck as Ahab.
Oh yeah,
it reminded me of the Confidence Man, where the whole point of the Melville book, the Confidence Man, is there's a guy on a steam train and people have encounters with supernatural sort of people that, and you can't tell whether they're the god, whether they're angels or devils. They all sort of put forth like a moral quandary, and they argue it in biblical terms and religious terms. But it's also like, hey, you're asking me to do something essentially satanic, but you're using biblical rhetoric to do it. And that's what the Confidence Man is all about. And that character, that scene completely reminded me of the Confidence Man, of also because he looks like Ahab, of just like this guy that like, is he Satan or not? Mm-hmm. John, can I ask you a question? Because we've stayed away from it. It's the biggest problem with the movie. The parable of Stefan Zanovich.
Boring scene? I don't know.
You're saying what I think. It's supposed to be a Shaggy Dog story, right? Where he gets out of prison and it sets it up like, here's some life advice that's going to help you. And then it's goddamn nothing. Isn't that what's supposed to be happening there? Or am I crazy?
Well, it's hard to say because the guy seems like a fool, right? And then is it his brother? Is that correct? Or
yeah,
are they just both?
The brother-in-law.
The older guy who comes back.
Right. They're related. The other guy basically is making fun of him when he comes in. So, yeah, I don't know what we're supposed to make of that. I don't know if it's supposed to be like this guy just kind of drudging on forever and then this other guy being like, what a moron this guy is.
No, that's like Beware the Holy Whore Fassbender mode. Like that's...
Nailed it on the head. Yes.
there's sort of a point to it in that, but like I sort of feel bad for anyone who wants to go into Berlin Alexanderplatz kind of blind, because like that first chapter is I think we all agree like the most difficult one to watch, because not much really happens and it kind of feels
boring.
Sort of tedious. It's boring. It's a boring scene, and like most of the film isn't boring. You're constantly like, oh, like, what's Franz going to do when he finds about Mitz's letter? Or, like, you get really caught up in it. So, like, it's kind of a strange beginning.
You know what section I got really caught up in this time that I literally didn't even remember was the widow that he romances and then looters, robs.
Yeah.
I didn't even remember it.
Absolutely.
And I was like, oh, my God,
I forgot about that, too. And, like, the photograph where, like, I think it's still the same actor,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's Gunther Lambrecht.
Mustache. The silly mustache. But, like, such a moving and strange kind of encounter. And the look on her face when she first sees him, and he doesn't know what's going on. And you find out that, he looks just like her dead husband. And that this, sort of sweet encounter.
Yeah. I also love with the shoelaces, when he gets the shoelaces pitch from Luders, and then they're both like, holy shit. Luders is like, are you gonna get everybody needs shoelaces, and they're like, wow.
It's like the first time somebody's ever said that and their minds are blown. I know. The look on their faces. I mean, it's also like, I think the first time I watched it, because what sort of sticks with you, it's scenes of people being mean to each other and people being run over by cars, that like, I kind of forgot. It's actually a very funny film for large portions. You know, there's a lot of jokes. There's a lot of
Fassbender's always funny. Fassbender's always funny.
Don't you love me anymore? Sure I do. It's long enough now.
Oh, Martin, we talked about Mildred Pierce a little bit. This movie actually, because you got me on the thought of what artworks it reminds me of. I mentioned The Sleepwalkers and The Confidence Man. You know what occurred to me this time when I was watching it is that, I was thinking about how the appearance of the angels sort of floating around him, it really reminded me of in Satanic Verses, where, you know, have either of you ever read that? A plane blows up going over the English Channel, and...
I haven't actually read it, but yes. I sort of know the
gist there's, of it, like, people falling to their death, and they, like, stop to have philosophical conversations with, like, angels and stuff. It reminded me of that, but also, like... I don't know how this...
And Fassbender similarly received death threats after this came out, so that's perfect.
But you know what never occurred to me, and it seems so obvious, is there's a guy who's sort of lost spiritually, and he's surrounded, having his fate decided by angels he can't see on the streets of Berlin, followed by these invisible angels. Sounds like...
Vim Wenders.
Yeah, Wings of Desire. I can't believe that never occurred to me before.
No, that's... When you say it like that, that's... Yeah, okay.
Oh, and the other, so I was just looking at my notes. One thing that the end of this film really drives home, in Dublin's book, the big hallucinatory sequence that ends the book is very obviously inspired by the Book of Revelation, which is famously, you know, the book.
Sure.
Yeah. And now it's sort of a cliche that book was written by a schizophrenic or somebody on psychotropic drugs. And... Dublin uses it to sort of look at the Book of Revelations through a psychiatric lens, the psychiatry that's coming to prominence in Germany and in Europe in the 20s, right? And so it's fascinating to think about all that stuff in terms of the Book of Revelation, because I think Fassbender drops all of that with his adaptation of it.
Well, what's really great is he has the scene with the psychiatrist, and they just feel like so far off. You know what I mean? Like when they're trying to do some kind of an analysis of like, oh yes, perhaps, you know, it's a catatonic stupor because of this, this, and this. And it's
by the 70s, Freudian psychology is a bit of a joke, you know? Although, and Doblin's book...
Well, I think it's like a bit of a joke in the film. Like it's...
Yeah. And I think that, I think the Doblin is influenced by, Mourning and Melancholia, the Freud. That's a book that's all about unnatural emotional attachments after death. And it's a book that's all about, like, after somebody dies, that's important to us, how we form emotional relationships going forward and form healthy or unhealthy ones. And I think that that's such a huge part of the book that I think Fassbender rejects all of the Freudian stuff, but like the traces of it remain in the film, which I think gives the film a great sort of inadvertent complexity. Like it gives it a texture to have that sort of that note and that voice singing still in the script, but that he's putting contrasts on top of it and different voice and instrumentation around it.
Like I do think it's good sometimes to have that complexity added in somebody approaching somebody else's point of view and saying like, what about this, or I reject this, and like I'm going to show you why by kind of working through like an already formed point of view.
Well, the reason that he's so relieved that she's been horribly murdered rather than, you know, gone off with another man is that, like, what he's holding himself, you know, what he's come to believe in is meets his inherent goodness and the reliability on that, like, goodness. It's like the one trait of the world that he can't find. It's the one trait he can't find in the world that he's found in her. So the idea, like, that she would go off and betray him and run away from him would, to him, you know, shatter this illusion that, like, there's this one good person in the world, this one tender person in the world. It's better to learn that she was horribly killed, because it's a way to reconcile the idea that there is a good and an evil side, and that the evil side overwhelming the good to him is better than good not existing at all, and that, you know, that she would have a negative side to her.
Do you think, is that the main take away from the film? Or do you think like something of this scope, like it's hard to have a single takeaway?
There are so many takeaways. I
Yeah.
think so. I think even that, you could say on the one hand, it's a relief to him and his belief in goodness that, she died a good person. At the same time, he's lost her and she's dead, and that sacrifice is going to like destroy him, and it's going to force him to completely withdraw from it, from everything. And
Yeah.
also his very complicated relationship with Reinhold, where he, will never condemn him no matter what he does, no matter how evil he is. He will, as long as he can, he will defend him, and even at his trial, he will not condemn him, when it means that he'll pay for his crimes.
There's when you asked what the theme of the movie was, Martin, it's funny, it's to go back to Brock's Sleepwalkers, it's hard for me not to think of this movie in terms of Sleepwalkers. There's one of the big things in Brock's book is all about the Salvation Army. There's like a whole subsection that's about it. And obviously the Salvation Army plays a big role in this movie where Reinhold is going to go sit on the sinner's bench. But he like gets furious when Franz is
Right.
like, "You should go sit on the sinner's bench." And the Salvation Army in Brock's book very explicitly represents the change that's happening in Christian values, that when Protestantism takes over and becomes more of a cultural force, Catholicism is there's a set of rules that are given to you by the clergy and by the good book, and then you have people within the religious structure that interpret them for you and tell you what they mean. Protestantism, everyone has access to their own Bible, has access to their own interpretation of the Lord's word, and you have to decide the meanings for yourself. The Salvation Army is representative of the sinner in salvation, Protestantism, right? And sort of this change that's happening. And for Brock, and I think for Fassbender, but not for Doblin, when every Brock thinks about it in Christian terms and Fassbender doesn't. But it's chaos when every human being has to decide on their own the difference between right and wrong and what good and evil is. That this is actually a really untenable way for any society to exist, with each individual as a Protestant finding their way to the sinner's bench and deciding whether they belong on the sinner's bench or not. That's actually a complete degradation of values and leads to a sort of cultural annihilation. That structure and order is actually really important in that regard. And I think that for Fassbender, he's concerned with the human aspect of how hard is it to try and decide, okay, you can say you're going to go straight. What the fuck does that actually mean? You know?
Well, I was just going to say, it's also that he's so withdrawn from having a moral choice. Another, since we're talking literary here, Dostoevsky's The Idiot. I feel like the story draws a lot upon the love triangle in that book between Mishkin and Roshkin, especially since it ends with the murder of the girl by Rogozin, and the whole idea is that the prince can't make up his mind and can't like commit to what he's going to do, and the alternative to that is like, okay, well then it's destruction, it's
Holy
evil.
shit, now I feel like I hadn't even thought of that. Now I feel like, well, Berlin Alexanderplatz is a ripoff of The Idiot. I feel
Oh,
it's a
that's a
perfect
really, really good
comparison.
comparison. Yeah.
It's very similar. Oh, I didn't even think of Dostoevsky. I was so caught up on the American Dostoevsky Melville that I didn't even think about it.
No, but Brock is another. I mean, Brock is even more appropriate since, like you said, it would have been writing at the same time. It would have been in the same kind of political environment, and definitely kind of had that same. I wouldn't have thought of that. That's really good.
Yeah. Let me ask you guys, go from one to the other. What is this time, what was your like, what's the big episode? What's your favorite episode or even sequence from it? Like, what's the one that jumps out really this time for you, John?
It's the one with the drinking
Handful of
is
people in the
the
depths of silence.
yes, thank you very much. I think that that's the one that for me most works best as it as an individual segment, as its own film. And I really like everything that's going on. I like the kind of robberies that are happening sort of in the background of it. And in terms of acting, I think it's pretty phenomenal and has a lot of great philosophical ideas. I wouldn't say like that's the best one or anything like that. I mean, I really think that the film doesn't really kick in until it gets into the main plot, and then that's like the core of the movie. That's the best part of the movie. But before we get into that part, I think that that one really stands out. And then once it's in that part, it's just, it's hard to sing, to put your finger on just like that one single moment. Although I love the classic, you know, when he goes into the beer hall and he just has the three beers lined up and he has his monologue where he's talking at the beers. That's always so much fun.
I'm a schnapps.
That's the part I really remembered from my first viewing, you know, really.
Me too.
I also, I gotta mention the heist that goes wrong at the end when Mech does the, like, power play where they're like, we should get in safes, and then he sets himself on fire.
Yeah, when he gets burned. Oh, that's a cool sequence.
It's so cool.
Set the fire.
Yeah, that sequence
it's
makes
almost
me
like
feel
thief
like...
Thief or I, something, like, when he's...
It's exactly like Thief. That's what I was gonna say. It makes me wish Fassbender had just once in his life directed a straight-up genre film, just to see what it would have been like. You know, because he has a talent for that stuff, you know? Anyway.
Oh, quickly, like, I just wanted to touch on the music a little bit, if you had thoughts, because there's score throughout, and then at the end, like, there's some more unusual...
they got the crap, anachronistic the music choices. Kraftwerk and the Lou Reed,
And the Bobby McGee. I didn't remember that being
Janis
on there
Joplin.
At all.
No, and the Leonard Cohen song that's specifically about Janis Joplin.
Oh, and Dean Martin. I didn't remember that. I didn't remember that Dino doing the Christmas song "Silent Night" was on there.
Oh yeah,
I'd completely forgotten that there's like Rat Pack on there.
Like you know, some bands or artists do it now, where there will be like music videos for each song in the album, and it kind of tells a story, but each one has its sort of different look. So like, I thought of that a little bit, like as they're changing up the visuals, and it's like, oh no, he's in the boxing ring with the spinning background. Like, it does have kind of like a music video quality, and like each part kind of tells a different, or it's like a retelling of a different part of Franz's story up to that point.
Yeah.
So it's like a musical retelling, maybe, or...
Yeah, it's a jukebox musical of a murder melodrama.
Right.
It's funny, this time watching it, I was thinking, it's really weird that... Because the Kraftwerk, I think, works best of all of that music. I think the Janis Joplin is an embarrassment when he's, like, going into prison and it's playing, like, freedom's just another word for nothing that do's. It's like, hey, again, get this out of my face. But the Kraftwerk is so good that I was like, it's weird that more filmmakers haven't leaned on Kraftwerk to fix their bad movies. It just seems
like... That's the one specific like, song, too, when he was asked what his ideal Sunday morning is, Fassbender. He said something like, a glass of champagne and caviar, and that Kraftwerk song is like his perfect Sunday morning.
He later added, I'll be dead by age 36. Just, you know, champagne, caviar, and Kraftwerk. I'll be dead soon, everybody. Just in case you're curious.
Oh, my God. It's so high on cocaine. It just felt like a 25-minute movie, but
I love the Pierre Raven score. I love the score for this movie so much, and I've always had that impression watching it this time was just like, this is the best. This score is the best, and the subtleties to it, the different themes associated with people, and the way he then twists
the variations
them,
on it. Yes,
that like Reinhold has his entrance music, which then gets played at moments to emphasize like the relationship between Mitza and Franz, you know, like how it's being, how Reinhold is hanging over it in that moment and all those different sorts of things he does with it. And how he'll sometimes play the melody, like in the big murder scene in the woods, he plays the melody that's been playing the whole movie, but it doesn't come to completion. It leaves the last few notes off of the melody. So it feels like it's getting choked off. Like you can feel it becoming tighter then, you know, I just love that score. I'm not as big a fan as of the epilogue as I am of the rest of the movie. And I think that the, hey, this is my record collection quality of it is less than thrilling. I think it needed more.
There's something about that last 2 hours that definitely pulls you out.
It is kind of interesting. Like, I kind of wish it was like its own separate thing, because it would be interesting to watch the whole story beginning to end and then go and watch that as a separate piece that was like a retelling of the whole thing. Like the fact that it kind of comes wedged right between like the climax and the end, like it does sort of throw you off in this strange way, because it does feel so separate.
Speaking of which, do you know that Fassbender had plans to do a theatrical version of this film that would have been completely different?
Yeah, with a different cast, right? Like, I could sort of understand if you wanted to do a version that was, like, using a lot of this footage and cut down and maybe, like, refilm certain things with the same cast.
But to have a whole new cast, it's like, didn't he run out of actors with this movie?
Yeah, like, why would you want to recast it completely? I thought that was sort of a strange point, but what if there was, like, a 12-hour version instead of a 15-hour? Would you be like, oh, like, the 15-hour, so much, you get so much more character out of it. Like, I don't know.
I think so. I think that this movie is, is just right. I really do, in terms of length and in terms of the individual episodes. I think that by the time it gets to Mitza, it feels like so much has happened that her presence feels like such a change. And the Reinhold stuff has been on such a slow boil that I think if you compress it at all, it feels like the 31 film, where, like you're saying, where you're like, whoa, slow down. You know, this is, you know, like, this is not, these are not, this is not fleshed out. You know?
Yeah, she becomes such an integral part of it.
I was thinking it's one of the only films where a character can say, like, I haven't seen you for a while, and you're like, yeah, it's been a while. Like, you know, when he shows back up after sort of detoxing and he's back in his old stomping grounds, that, you know, I think it's the guy who's, like, selling the magazines. He's like, hey, Franz, like, you know, where have you been? I'm like, yeah, like, it's been a long time since they've seen each other. And you really feel that, like, a lot of films, you kind of have to just, like, suspend your disbelief.
You definitely feel that. And then she becomes so integral to the plot that when her story is over so abruptly, you're like, oh, wait, what? That's the end of the movie?
Yeah.
Oh, no, there's only, like, 3.5 hours left to wrap this up. Oh, no. Like, I mean, you do actually get that feeling when it's like, oh, how is he going to, like, bring it all together in, like, only 3 hours? Or,
right.
You know.
It's funny you mentioned the newspaper guy. One thing I would like to say about the Criterion edition, which I watched this time, I don't love the translation on it. Because, like, the newspaper guy is like, ah, my ball hurts. And then there's secondary characters who are like, what's up, baby? What's going on? You know, like, the one of the rich guys says that to Eva, and there's a few times where the book is super duper slangy, and I read the translation of it that's sort of famously, like, too slangy, that people hate. That I think it's from, like, the mid-30s is when it was done, and it's all like, my boy, come here, hey, eh? You know, just like all of this sort of, like, slangy. I think I'm not sure what translation is on the prints, but it struck me this time as, like, they are really failing to do justice to the slangy of this on the Criterion translation, which I never had that impression before.
Having previously only had experience with the VHS copies, I was just glad that you could read them and they were in the center of the screen.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, is that the 35mm prints are white subtitles. So anytime those white intertitles came up, couldn't read them. It was like, literally, like, before this time, I don't think I knew what any of those intertitles said that are like, she's like a little girl, her room is impossibly clean.
Mm-hmm. We've come so far. Well, I guess that probably about wraps things up. It was great, great conversation. Where can folks find you online?
They can find us at thepeaksmoke.com. New article every week. Check it out.
Every Tuesday.
We're getting a new article from Martin Kessler up there pretty soon.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be there before this episode is. I hope.
Then 3 weeks ago we had.
Yeah, so I hope you read that Martin Kessler.
Thank you, and thank you both for coming on again and for, you know, spending 15 and a half hours of your time.
Dude, it was so great to revisit it. It was so great to have an excuse to revisit it. Really, really.
I would say 14 hours and 45 minutes of it were absolute bliss.
Right. Because I think I told you before, like, so often the length just kind of dominates the conversation, so I really appreciated getting into the nitty-gritty of all of it. So thank you both, and folks listening,
can I leave you with one quote from the Bible that I think is really important in terms of this film?
Please.
From Isaiah. I'm deadly serious. When you watch this movie, if you're going to watch it for the first time, in Isaiah, I form the light and create darkness. I make peace and create evil, because I am the Lord who does all these things.